This morning we're going to talk about innovative curriculum. Thanks. And our first speaker will be Laurel Oates from Puget Sound, followed by Ralph Brill. They will both talk about a three-year program. The third speaker will be Shirley Barzowitz from the University of Connecticut. She will talk about the library staff's role in teaching. After the three presentations, we will have a panel in which Marjorie Lombard and Wayne Chapel will also participate. And our first speaker is Laurel Oates.
When I was preparing my presentation for this morning, I sat down to consider the two questions that most of us have to ask ourselves anytime we start to plan a program or begin planning any particular class within that program. And that is, what do I want to present and how do I want to present it? Unfortunately, in the process of trying to answer those questions, I found that I could not practice what I preach. There are a number of things that I'm going to talk about today that I think that are essential for building good programs and conducting good classes within those programs. But as it is with most things, ideals are sometimes not attainable. For example, my restrictions today are I'm limited today by restrictions of time. What I have to say could fill several hours instead of just 30 minutes. Also by physical restrictions. I have to, although I would never in my own classroom do so, stand behind a podium in front of a microphone at a level higher than you are. Not my idea of a good teaching technique or a way to establish a good relationship with the people I'm supposedly talking with about something. Nor can I get you out of your row, something else that I, as a teacher, don't want to do. But it is a valuable lesson in that everything we are going to talk about today is probably the ideal. And those ideals have to be taken and measured against the practicalities of our own programs, the financial restraints, the support that we have from our various schools, and the kinds of freedom that we have to do what we want to do versus what everyone else wants to do. So, having said that, I'd like to begin, and the topic of the presentation this morning is the ideal curriculum. What should we do and how should we do it? I'd like to emphasize during my presentation that the second part of that. How should we go about doing it? I think that's probably the easier of the two parts. My materials are in two different versions, and you'll need to refer to them. If you can have access to it, the blue notebooks are the complete versions. And since there are no longer 90 people here, I think there are about 45 copies to go around. There is an incomplete version. It was 70 pages long, and we had some discussion yesterday about being able to actually photocopy 70 pages of this material. And so in your stack, you're going to find another packet. You don't have a blue notebook. It looks like it's a bunch of the closet within the house, and those are on the table too. So you need either a blue notebook or one of these.
Thank you.
If you have the little packet, you need to also turn to your information booklet, because the outline is in that and we didn't want to duplicate. So if you want to turn either to the front page of the blue book or in the program materials that you got yesterday to the outline for my presentation, what you'll see is that I have fairly arbitrarily set out a five-step approach for planning an ideal legal writing program. The first step of that process requires us to come up with a theoretical basis for our programs. And in order to do that, we're going to have to, at least for most of us, step outside the four walls of the law school. We're going to have to go and look to some of the other disciplines and learn from those people. And the first place that we're going to have to go look is we're going to have to look to those people in our education departments and our psychology departments for information about learning theory. How do people actually learn? Most of us did not take education programs as undergraduates. Most of us have not read any of the literature on learning theory. And we need to go back and try to collect that kind of information. And there's a lot of it, and a lot of it is written in jargon that is as foreign to us as law is to the people who write that particular material. But essentially, there's some things that we need to look at. One, they talk about active versus passive learning. Which is better? What constitutes active learning? What constitutes passive learning? Can't give lectures today on what each of these mean, but these are just things for you to look at and try to find some resources. Second thing we need to look at is how much can the typical person absorb and learn at one time? Sometimes within a 50-minute class, we may throw out 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times more.
Can you just give us
try not to get you. 8, 9, 10 times more than our students can realistically learn in that particular time period. And what's going to happen is perhaps instead of learning everything, that won't happen, they may learn nothing. We may give them so much that they end up walking away not even with one piece of those 8 or 9 or 10 things that we wanted to accomplish. So we need to learn how much can our students learn in any given day. The other thing that we need to do is we need to look at the need for practice. Goes back to what Mary Lawrence was talking about yesterday, and that you need to not only teach something once, you need to keep teaching it, you need to give students an opportunity to practice. You'll find the word spiraling in some of the literature. The other things that you need to look at are the levels of cognitive development. One of the things that has amazed me both as a law student and then going back and sitting in law classes as an observer, not as the teacher, is the kind of skills that we ask our students to do. The very first day, we typically ask our students to do the very basic kinds of things that they could do probably back, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade, plus the most sophisticated kind of cognitive development, things that most of them have never tried to do successfully. That doesn't work. What they've done, and there are many, many taxonomies of cognitive development, this particular one comes from, and I have part of an article for you if you want to look. Unfortunately, the page numbers are not real clear. It is the one that has the pyramid, and it's very faintly marked, page 18. Did you find that one? It comes from an AALS publication on learning and evaluation in law schools by Michael Josephson. And what he's tried to do is to take those taxonomies and make them applicable for law school learning. And what it is it sets out the lowest level of being knowledge, knowing vocabulary, knowing what a rule of law is, knowing what books are in the library, essentially informational skills. You cannot go any higher up on the ladder of cognitive learning until you have the knowledge. The second step is understanding. The third step is issue spotting. Fourth step, problem solving, judgment, and synthesis. The point being is that you can't do the higher levels until you've mastered the lower levels. And therefore, if you're going in and you're asking your student to do something that requires judgment, before you've given them the skills and given them or taught them how to do the lower level things, you're not going to be successful. You're asking them to do something that they don't have the ability to do. So in planning our curriculums, we need to plan our curriculum so we provide the building blocks. We set the foundation and then we build on that particular foundation. So there are lots of things out there about learning theory. I am by no means an expert, and if anyone is, we need to learn from them and they should come forward. The next thing that we need to do is we need to go to another discipline. We need to go, if you don't have somebody in your English department on your staff, you need to go and knock on their doors. You need to find people who have expertise and who have studied composition theory. And there are lots of them out there. Some of the people that are here today just came from the 4Cs conference in Minneapolis, Renee and Chris, in which there are, 4,000 people who study composition who were gathered together to talk about developments in composition theory. But we need to learn some of that. We are in one of the many things that we have to do, composition teachers. And you'll find that it gets from the very simple to the very complex. And if you want to look on page 20, which is the one that has the little boxes with the little arrows, you can find a very, very basic diagram of the writing process, in that you start with pre-writing, and that pre-writing for many of us is the longest or the biggest or whatever most important stage. It's a stage where we begin to identify issues, where we collect facts, where we go to the library and do our research, where we come back and collect some more facts, where we talk about our writing, where we think about our writing, where we pre-plan what we're going to write. All the little things that you do while you're jogging or laying in bed at night, those are all a very important part of the pre-writing stage. And if we design our curriculum so that we do not give our students adequate time or adequate activities at that pre-writing stage, then the final product is probably not going to be as good as it should be. Then you have the writing stage. That's where you actually put pen to paper and you try to get something down. That's fine. That often, though, is not where we can stop. When we sit down to write, all of a sudden we discover We haven't thought about it enough. We haven't done enough research. We don't have all the facts we need. So we go back to the pre-writing stage, and we then come back to the writing. Some of us go around in circles for a long time. Unfortunately, some of our students never get beyond that stage. Because after you've done the writing stage, you have to go on to the rewriting stage. That's where you continue revising, thinking about it, refining. For most of us, that's where we take it from writer-oriented, writing for myself, to reader-oriented prose. Sitting down and trying to translate what we have figured out and how we've mastered the material and putting it into a format that will work for the person who has to read our material. And we need to give our students, first of all, permission to write for themselves first, but also information and the motivation to turn around and make that something that is readable and understandable by the audience that it's intended for. The last stage is a stage that we tend to probably emphasize too much, comes too early in the process, and that's the editing stage. That's where you put in the commas, you make sure the words are spelled right, you make sure you take out the expletives, you try to take out the passive voice. Those are the kinds of things that are easy for us to mark on a piece of paper. But they should be the very last stage. They actually require the least complicated or least complex skills that we ask from our students. The paper isn't any good without them, but that should not be the point of emphasis, probably. Within that, you can see the next page, that process gets very, very complicated. The next page gives you a much more complex version of the writing process in which you have the writing process in the middle of those three blocks. And above it, you have a task environment, and you have the writer's long-term memory. And you begin to see how all those pieces go together. And on the back side is an explanation that Chris Rideout, my colleague, put together of that process. And what it does, it says, you have to think about audience. You have to think about the context in which you're writing. And therefore, we need, in developing our assignments, to make sure our students have a clear audience. Do they know who they're writing for? Do they know what the purpose of the document is? Do they know what context this document is written in? That's hard to do in the artificial environment of a law school, but there are ways that we can work around it. We then need to go back, probably, to our education departments. And we need to expand our repertoire of teaching skills. We need to be able to feel comfortable teaching in a large number of ways. And we also need to find out which way works best in which circumstance. And I've just listed a whole bunch of different teaching methods that we have at our disposal and that we typically will use during the course of a year in teaching legal writing. You know, day one, you may have simulation. You want to write a client letter. You want them to have a sense of audience. So you find your best friend or a third year student or your spouse or someone to come in and play the part of the client to role play for you, someone the students don't know. Sometimes you have problems. Sometimes you do collaborative learning. Sometimes you teach through letting students read. Sometimes you teach from letting students write, both what they write on their paper for just for themselves and what you may write back on their paper. You teach in the classroom, you teach out of the classroom. There are just literally dozens and dozens of different techniques and combinations of techniques that you have to have at your disposal, and you have to know what they can accomplish and when they're most likely to work so that you can plug them into your curriculum at the appropriate times and places. You may get a pet. I mean, I love simulation, I love collaborative learning. I've had to learn when those work and when they don't work and to use them appropriately. What that does is to give you a theoretical basis for beginning to plan a curriculum. You have to have all that information in order to be able to sit down and start going on to the next steps. And we are then ready to move on to step two. The second step requires you to sit down and establish goals for your program and objectives for your program as a whole. For those of us who have a program that lasts for more than one semester or more than 1 year, that means for the program as a whole. And then you need to sit down and you need to do it for each course within your program. And the very first article in the materials, The Closet Within the House, which comes from a collection of essays on legal education, talks to you about establishing goals and objectives within the law school context. I'm not sure whether the product of that process is terribly important. I think it's important for students in the outside world to do it. I'm not so sure for those of us who work in them it's important. But the process of putting those together is terribly important. And it's also important, I think, that you do it with a group of people. At the University of Puget Sound, we were lucky in that we had four of us who were devoted to trying to come up with goals and objectives for our program. and there were hours and hours and days of discussion and some fighting, and we came up with objectives and goals for our program, which are now a number of years old, Attachment D, which is page 36, and we probably would go back and change some of them now based on what we've learned. But it set down for us and made us crystallize in our own minds what it is we wanted to accomplish. Right prior to that is an article which those of you in the blue notebooks have, but those of you who do not have the blue notebook do not have, but you have a cite to it at an end. It is an article from the Journal of Legal Education written by Roger Anderson, who I do not know, stating objectives for a legal writing course, in which he went through a number of years ago and set out objectives. All those do is provide some models for you of the kinds of goals and objectives that other people have set out, and you can then decide which of those you agree with, which of those you disagree with. After you've done that, you then need to get real specific. You need to come up with goals and objectives for every single class that you're going to teach. And you need to know how those goals and objectives fit together. And in the course of doing that, you also need to come up with a syllabus. What we've done at the University of Puget Sound, and if you want to find page 39, is we have for each class sat down and put together what we call a class sheet. These are materials that are for those of us who teach in the program. And what we do is we set out the objectives. The instructor objectives are set in terms of what we, as the people who are organizing and administering the program, want our instructors to accomplish in that particular class period. They then need to turn around and change those objectives for the objectives for their students. For example, on page 39, to review with students the purpose and audience of an office memo. That's what we want the instructors to do. The instructor for the students would say, I want my students to understand the purpose and audience of an office memo. The language gets, you have some strict guidelines if you read the stuff from education departments. It's not so important as though coming up with what it is you want to accomplish in that particular class period and making sure that it is consistent with your goals and objectives for the course and for your program, and that one set class day follows the goals and objectives of the next class day. The other thing that you need to do after you've done that, just for your information, in the blue notebook there is long syllabus for our course, and you can see what kind of syllabus what to do, is you need to put the pieces together. And that is by far the hardest task that you're ever going to be faced with. What I've done is I put up on the board all the things that you need to do. Essentially what you need to do is you need to mesh everything with on that side of the board with everything that's on this side of the board. I mean, you need to figure out that you're going to teach the subject matter of research. You want to teach composition, meaning you want to teach large-scale organization to your students, small-scale organization, sentence construction, etc. You need to teach them how to write an office memo, client letter. You need to teach them oral advocacy. You need to teach them citation. You may want to teach them legal method. You may want to teach them legal analysis. So these are all the substance of your course. Those are all the things that you need to take into consideration in trying to figure out what you're going to teach when. And it's a very complex job, and the reason I don't think there can be a model legal writing program is I think there are many ways of putting those pieces together. But you need to visualize, these are all the things I have to do, and now how am I going to put them together? And as we've all heard from talking to each other, there are a number of ways of doing that. And I'll talk about the program at UPS very briefly in a minute. After you've done that, you're ready to move on to the third stage of developing a program. That stage is one where you have to select and train your staff, and you have to select materials. One of the things that you need to take into consideration is you have to hire people and staff your program with people who, first of all, know what the theoretical basis of your program is. It's no good for you to know it and have based a whole program if you don't communicate that and if they don't agree with you. I mean, you have to have them buy in, as the language goes, to your particular program and your theory for your program. And then you need to train them. You need to train them to know about learning theory. You need to train them in composition theory. You need to train them so that they know how to use all the teaching methods that you're going to be using in your program. You need to know that they're competent to teach each of the subject matters that you've put into your program. Again, not an easy task, and one which you're going to have to persuade schools if they're going to we have to do one of two things. Either they have to make legal writing staffs permanent so people develop these skills and will be with them year after year after year, or we have to have intensive training sessions for our new instructors every year. University of Puget Sound, the instructors come 3 weeks early and they spend 3 weeks in a training session, and there at the end of the syllabi that you see, there is a syllabi for our training session in which we sit down and we try to train our instructors. That begins at page 53. So that's 3 weeks in August. So before the first day of class, they learn about as many of these things as we can fit into those 3 weeks, plus they learn the subject matter that they're going to be teaching and review the subject matter that they're going to be teaching. Those are then followed up with two-hour training sessions every week during the course of the school year, where we go back and what are we going to do next week, how are we going to do it, and what are some ideas for doing it better than we'd originally planned. We also train them by giving them as much as we can to work from at the very beginning. Again, there's the class sheets. We give them suggested teaching methods. We give them suggested lecture notes for substantive materials. That doesn't mean they lecture, but that gives you the content that you can look at. We give them about a 600-page book of articles on all of these topics, indexed so that they can find what they need in a particular day. We give them samples of materials, samples of in-class exercises, samples of collaborative learning exercise, simulation examples. We have file cabinets of stuff that we're putting together so that there are resource files there. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. That makes their job a little bit easier. The other part of that is developing materials. And there's still not materials available that do all these pieces for us. You have to pick and choose and supplement to an extensive basis. On an extensive basis, usually what you need for your program. Step four is putting your program into practice, and the word there is, we work very, very hard and think we think of everything, and we never do, and we're constantly changing things, and I guess that's what makes it interesting and why you can do it from year to year. Our second year program now is very stable. It goes on from year to year. With essentially no glitches. Our first-year program, and partially it's just the nature of first-year programs, you're dealing with students who know nothing and you're trying to teach them everything at once. We're still playing with. We change it every year, trying to come up with a better model. But what helps us do that is, one, watching what goes on in our own classrooms, but also extensive evaluations from the people that are involved. Evaluations from people who administer it, evaluations from people who teach in it, evaluations from other faculty members, and we consider very important evaluations from the students. And I have in the back on page 59 a sample of the course evaluation from fall semester a year ago for our second year legal writing program, in which we, you can see, asked students to essentially evaluate every activity that we did in class, telling us whether they thought it was very valuable, or not valuable, and whether we should spend more time, less time, or the same amount of time on it. Unfortunately, our sheet was not clear enough, and most of them only checked, we were supposed to check two times. They weren't smart enough to check two times, so we have a no answer column on each side. But also asking them to evaluate the assignments, their classroom instruction, knowing that the program and the instruction in that program are interrelated, and you have to look at both. And what's most interesting probably is on page 65, the ultimate question. I mean, how do you ever decide whether we've actually taught them anything? 54 of the students who responded said that they had learned to write more persuasively. Two of them said they had, and 51 said that they had learned to present an oral argument better. Five said no, or maybe I got them around the other way. Yeah, no, five said. So asking them what they perceive their abilities to be. That's somewhat insignificant in that, although it may be just rationalization, one of the things we've had to learn is what we're teaching may not have the short-term results that we want. We may be teaching for a product that will come and actually blossom 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road. We're laying a groundwork, but until they get the practice that they need, they won't actually be able to execute all the things that we would like them to be able to execute. That is a process that we can go through to do it. Very briefly, in about 3 or 4 minutes here, I will outline for you what the legal writing program is at the University of Puget Sound. There's a complete description in the back there of the program. Probably the most significant thing about it on a piece of paper is that it is not a one-year program. It is a two-year program. Our students take 3 credits of required legal writing in their first year, and we're teaching in that program advisory and expository writing and research, and then they take a separate 3-credit course in their second year in which they learn appellate advocacy, trial advocacy, both in written and oral form. That gives us a tremendous advantage over most of you, and that we have a lot more time to try to accomplish all these things. We haven't had to cut as much from our programs as most of you would have to cut. The other things I think that make our programs different is that we really have tried to do the things that I've set out here for you in the board. And we tried to sit down and educate ourselves as to learning theory, as to composition theory, as to the different kinds of teaching methods that are available, and to consciously sit down and try to integrate that into a planned curriculum in which skills are presented sequentially. The easiest things are presented first, and what comes second follows from what came first, what comes third follows from what came first and second, etc. That is not perfect, but it is something that works better than the way we had done it before, where things were just kind of thrown at the students. The other thing that makes our method probably unusual is in the fact that we do train our instructors. Like I said, we spend a considerable amount of training, and we are no better than most law schools, but we are hoping to develop a program where we can keep instructors at least 2 years, and with any luck, more than 2 years, so that we begin to have a basis of people who are highly trained and highly skilled in writing, on teaching writing. The other thing that we do that I think is very important is that we give considerable emphasis to teaching writing itself. We do that within the context of the legal things that they're writing, but we do teach writing. We try to teach them large-scale organization. We try to teach them how to write paragraphs, how to write transitions. We do those things, and we do a lot of it, and we do it in the context of the writing process. We tell students about the writing process, and we try to plan activities that will be conducive to them doing and going through that writing process. The other thing that makes our program unusual is that, although it's not 100%, we have tremendous support from our faculty who do not teach legal writing. We are integrating our materials into their courses, and they no longer see us as the enemy, but as a friend and someone who can help them accomplish what they want to accomplish, which is making the next part of our program, what we hope to have in actually two parts of it, possible. Right now we only have 2 years of legal writing, first year and second year. It's no good. You can't just stop writing. You don't stop writing as an attorney. They need a tremendous amount of practice. So we're trying to look for ways to integrate writing beyond the legal writing classroom. A number of our faculty are beginning to put writing into their second and third year classes as seminar papers or other shorter kinds of writing assignments. And that is one way. We've added a new class called Language and the Law, which is based on White's book that he was talking about yesterday, The Legal Imagination. We're looking to establish drafting courses and some of the other kinds. We, at this point, essentially skip wherever I quit. This material, pleadings, contracts, wills, statutory, drafting, that kind of thing from our program. We don't have time to do everything. We've skipped that part. The other thing we're looking at is that writing is more than just a communication skill. Most of our legal writing courses are geared for students to be writing so that their writing will be read by someone else. In the process of teaching writing, though, we have come to believe that writing has an equally important role in a law student's legal education, and that is writing just to learn. That in the process of that writing stage, the pre-writing and the writing, there's a tremendous amount of learning that goes on. Ideas that sounded good to you when you said them out loud or when you read them, finally get them on paper, they don't sound so good. You realize that step B doesn't follow from A. You haven't taken your analysis far enough. And so through a grant that we've received from FIPSI, we're looking at ways in which we can use writing for learning, that students would not write to be published or read by someone else, but they would write simply for themselves to learn the law, you know, master information, but also to learn how to do some of the more sophisticated cognitive skills, how to use writing to do problem solving, issue spotting, understanding, all those other kinds of skills. My time is up, and that's how I will make my announcements. One, we have established as a result of last summer's conference on legal writing that we had in Tacoma, a legal writing institute, and if you did not get a copy of our newsletter, there are copies on the tables. Those of you who got them, you don't need to pick up. If you'd like to be added to our mailing list, if you'd write your name and address down on a piece of paper and either give it to Chris, raise your hand, Chris, or to me today, we will add your names to our mailing list. Second of all, the board of directors for that group will be meeting today at noon, and we're meeting on the first floor of this building at 12:30, so if somebody I haven't told, you now know that. Have I forgotten anything, Chris, I'm supposed to announce? Okay, I will quit then.
Thank you, Laurel. Our next speaker is Ralph Brill.
Ralph, can I add one thing I forgot?
Sure.
There's an article in your packet which was meant to discourage us all, and it's an article on teaching methods in which says that the teaching method makes no difference whatsoever. And you might want to read that to bring you down to what I just said.
Laurel's a very tough act to follow. I did not intend to talk about method, but curriculum itself, and the curriculum specifically that we've adopted at Chicago Kent. In 1978, I read an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, about a law firm in New York, Sherman Sterling, which is a very large law firm. Most of its graduates are from the prestige law schools out east. And Sherman and Sterling felt it was having a problem with some of the young associates. Frankly, they thought it was among some of the partners too, but they couldn't say that with their research and writing. And so they hired a language and writing specialist to work with their young associates. It's become fairly common since at most of the firms. And he first set up a class of 20 students, 20 of the young associates. He asked each of them to turn into him their two best writing samples, self-selected, anything they'd ever written in their lives, in law school, after law school. And he would go through those and pick out models of good writing. And you know the punchline, of course, he could not find anything to use as a model of good writing. He said, among other things, that they had serious organizational problems. They seemed to have done the work, they organized it in the order in which they did the work. They forgot that they were writing for an audience. They let the facts speak to them for themselves. They never heard of paragraphs. They spoke in ponderous language and all the things you see in your freshman classes. If Sherman and Sterling had a problem, and it did, that was prevalent throughout the country, and it was prevalent here in Chicago as well. Our dean decided that we should try to do something about this, rather than do what was typically done at that time, which was to blame the colleges for not properly training their students in writing. And the colleges, in turn, of course, would blame the high schools and all the way back to the womb. But not too many people did anything about it. And so he asked us to develop what we thought might be a three-year writing program that would be obviously less than perfect, but something a lot better than what we had. And hopefully the faculty would buy a part of it, and we could get started and hopefully aim for it in the future. To our surprise and to somewhat my chagrin, because I had to implement the program immediately instead of several years later, the faculty bought the entire package. And so we have, and have had since 78, a three-year research and writing requirement. Our students take five separate courses spread over the 3 years. 11 hours out of the 90 hours required for graduation. That's 12% of their total required courses required for graduation. All these are graded, so it automatically has a large impact upon their grade point average, which gives it instant attention and credibility. I happen to have also been the most senior member of the faculty, which also lent it credibility. It wasn't just being staffed by young graduates or students. I will try and go through the program course by course and then talk about some of the overall things and objectives of it at the end. In the first year, there are two courses, the early writing one and two, five semester hours total, three and two. In the first semester, we concentrate on memo writing and objective writing. They're taught by 10 full-time instructors. I think, I haven't counted, but I think it's probably the largest full-time staff in the country. These are usually people 3 or 4 years out of law school. Most of them are interested in teaching careers to come back and stay with us for 2 years, possibly a third. They have sections of 20 students each, a maximum of 40 students per instructor. Each of them has one student teaching assistant, a senior student of high standing, and usually law review or McCourt, high grade point average. I want to emphasize, however, that it's the instructor who teaches the course, who grades the papers. The teaching assistant is an assistant and not the teacher. The students during the course of the semester will do three memos of increasing size and difficulty, and they rewrite the first two. They are required to rewrite. Throughout our curriculum, we emphasize rewrites, and I will emphasize that from time to time in talking. They would start out in the first several weeks with in-class instruction on legal method, legal analysis, what a memorandum is, case analysis, a discussion problem to go through as a sample memo. The first assignment, of course, is a closed memorandum. They've not yet had enough on legal research to be able to do one of their own. That one is an eight-page memorandum, 8 pages of discussion. It is fully critiqued by the instructor, at least. Some of the instructors also allow the teaching assistants to grade at least a portion of the papers or all of them for either citation form or stylistic concerns as an aide. And those are fully rewritten after the critique. During the first 6 weeks of the semester, the teaching assistants also meet with the students for two hours per week to teach them legal research. And those are conducted in the library in two-hour sessions, concentrating on one tool per session. 1 week they would do ALR with a demonstration of it, how to use it, problems for the students to do. Teaching assistant would then critique those, show them how they could have done it better. The next week would be legal periodicals, digests, and so on. We did not teach in the first year anything about loose leaf services or legislative histories, or more advanced kinds of research. We bar them from using the computer during the first year because we teach that in our second year course. The second assignment then is given out at about the fifth or sixth week part of the semester, and that's an open memo in which the students have to do a full research. It's 10 pages of discussion. The first two assignments, the instructors are told that they must use a problem within one of the courses that the students are taking in the first year, that is torts, contracts, property or criminal law for the day students, or torts or contracts in the evening. But they are especially encouraged not to use materials that the students would have ever already have covered in class at the time that they do the assignment, something that would be coming up later in the semester. And I want to emphasize that now because I will be emphasizing it throughout, that we constantly give them materials that are beyond what they have covered already, that they have to learn on their own initially, that they have to learn that they can analyze materials that they have not received guidance in by somebody else or somebody else's pre-existing notions. And they're not terribly disaffected by that. They're not disadvantaged by that because of the rewrites. Since at the time of the rewrite, they will have full input from the instructor with a critique on the paper, a class discussion, and conferences. When they rewrite the material, they will have lots of help, and it will be primarily an exercise in composition and in drafting. The second memorandum, as I said, was 10 pages. It, too, is then rewritten after a full critique by the instructor and some aspect of the teaching assistant. The third memorandum is then a fully researched memo. It is 15 pages. It counts 50% of their course grade. We count the first draft of their first paper, the first 8-page closed memorandum, very little, 5% of the total grade. The rewrite on that paper counts 15%. The second paper is 15 and 15, 15 for the first draft and 15 for the rewrite. We know that they're going to have difficulty in making the adjustment to law school and learning all these things at once. And so we tell them that basically they're little babies that are going to be crawling for a while. Eventually they will begin to toddle and walk, and hopefully by the end of the semester they will begin running. And that's why we then reward that last paper with the most credit, and basically their grade in the course is going to be mostly affected by that last paper. The teaching assistant, besides teaching the research aspect of the class, assists the instructor in preparing problems, in doing research for the memorandum assignments. They help in counseling the students. They're up in the library themselves. If a student has a problem with research, they're available for answering questions. Most of the instructors delegate some aspect, at least, of the critiquing process. As I said before, either the citation form and grammar and spelling, or they may give, let's say, 10 of the papers to critique fully in addition to their own critique, and then rotate that so that they have another 10 students for the rewrite and another 10 students for the second paper and so on. The third assignment, the instructors are no longer limited to the torts, contracts, property, criminal law. They may extend the problem to something else that the students have not taken or will not be taking in their first year, so long as they feel that it's something that freshman law students can handle. I would be upset if they tried any antitrust problem, but a domestic relations problem or even a simple constitutional law issue is permissible. The second semester is a two-semester hour course, although I think the students probably do more work in it than they do in the first. The first assignment is an appellate brief, and there is a moot court competition that goes with that. Again, there is a rewrite of that brief. The page limitation on that one is 25 pages for the argument section. We use five, this year we use five problems that were distributed throughout the 16 sections of legal writing. And so there was a competition among the members of three or four sections as part of the Moot Court Society's freshman competition. We typically use very current legal issues, often cases that are pending or have been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. This year, for example, we used as one of the problems the peremptory challenge of jurors on a racial basis. We had a problem involving pulling the plug on somebody who was had only a minimal brain function with a dispute among family members as to whether to do that, and several other constitutional issues usually. Our students didn't take constitutional law in their first year. So again, they are writing in an area that is they've not been instructed in. They have 4 weeks to do a first draft of their papers. And they find, to their surprise, that in that short 4 weeks, they can master very, very well a fairly complicated area that they've had no instruction in and do a competent job, at least, on the first draft. If that were their only experience, I'd be very worried about that. But since they then go through a moot court argument and learn a great deal more about the subject matter than they ever knew before, and then have a critique in the paper, in class discussion, in conferences to go back over it, the rewrites turn out very, very, very good. The second assignment during the semester is an optional, the students are given an option, to do either a second brief or a law review article. The instructors prepare two separate problems, or at least two. They may actually prepare more than that, let the students choose between them. Those students who are interested in trying out for law review as candidates, most of our students reach law review through a candidacy program in their second year, will of course choose the law review assignment as an opportunity for the experience, for the critique, the opportunity to rewrite it. It of course is a different style of writing, and they get exposure to that as well. Those who feel that they may not want to be on law review or think that they will be litigators when they graduate from law school typically choose the brief. We vary the style of the brief. We use a different set of rules. Instead of U.S. Supreme Court rules, we may adopt the state form, Illinois Supreme Court, or some other state court, just to get an exposure to a different form of a brief. That one, likewise, is critiqued and rewritten after the critique. And that one is a 20-page brief. Once again, the instructors may choose any topic they feel freshmen can handle. The second year, we have two required courses for the students. One of them, at least, is fairly unique, and it is called Advanced Research. We rotate this. We offer both of them, both courses each semester. Half the students will take one in one semester and the other the next. Advanced Research is a two-hour course. And in it, the students may choose a section devoted to taxation or securities or labor law or environmental law or international law. The courses are team taught with an instructor, a prime instructor, and several others doing the various functions I'll describe in a moment. They are very small sections. There are 12 sections per semester, 15 students maximum per semester, per section. The first several weeks, the prime instructor will meet with the students and talk a little bit about, let's assume they're talking about labor law, educate them in basic labor law. They have not had labor law, and they will probably not be taking it simultaneously, at least in the first semester of the second year. And so the instructor does a mini review of all the labor laws, the major kinds of problems, and the kinds of materials that are used in labor law and labor law research. In tax, for example, they would go through the levels of courts and the precedential value of revenue rulings and IRS letters and tax courts and things of that sort. And then they would focus on the specialized tools of research within those areas, the loose-leaf services, the specialized kinds of treatises that you have to use, and the different kind of method that you have to use in doing research in those areas. The students then meet for 4 class hours for computerized legal research training in both Lexis and Westlaw. Those are taught by several different people. I teach one or two sections myself. Jim Sproul from our faculty teaches a couple. And then we have some adjuncts, our former Lexis and Westlaw instructors who formerly worked for those companies, who teach the classes. They are given in-class, hands-on instruction. Obviously, we use the computers in the computer center a lot for that. They also have outside-of-class assignments on their own. A first assignment would just get them used to the keyboard. A second on formulating search requests. A third on doing a small research problem and then comparing by traditional means, and then comparing the results to what they would have found by using one of the computers. They then have 4 class hours on legislative histories. Incidentally, in the last session in class of the computerized legal research, the instructor would focus on whatever the specialty is that group of students has chosen. If they're the tax law section, he or she would then emphasize doing tax research on Westlaw and Lexis during that period. The legislative histories people do the same thing. During the first 2 hours, they talk basically about the basics, the CIS system, the microfilm, microfiche, congressional record, the importance of debates and hearings, the relative weight, precedential value, and then they would focus on legislative histories of the securities laws or the labor laws or whatever it is in that section. At that point, they receive their first major assignment. They've done several shorter research type of assignments from the prime instructor, and it is designed to utilize all the tools that they've now been exposed to, the loose leafs, the computerized legal research. They're in fact required to turn in their printouts on Lexis or Westlaw on what they have found, what their search requests were, and how many cases they found and what those cases were, and attach those to their papers. These are 20-page assignments. The instructors are allowed to choose whatever form they would like. They may do another brief, they may do a memo, they may do a law review article, opinion letters, trial briefs, any of the various kinds of legal assignments that the lawyers would have to do. And they are fully critiqued by the instructors. Meanwhile, the students would also gain some additional research skills. We offer two hours of class on other information sources. First, other databases, Nexus and Dialog, and the very specialized computer databases that are now available, both legal and non-legal. If you have a medical malpractice problem, Medline is a wonderful source of information, and most lawyers don't know anything about it. We also offer instruction during that two-hour session in empirical research on finding statistics and other hard data that is necessary quite often in research. If you have a products liability case and you want to know what the product experience has been, or finding the patent on the article, how to go about doing that. The second assignment then incorporates that aspect as well as everything that preceded it. So they again would do a legislative history, legal, the computer, and now integrate some other empirical research or other database management kind of problem. Again, I emphasize that they have not taken or are taking simultaneously any of these courses on tax or securities or environmental law or labor or whatever else I left out. And so once again, they are forced to do research in an area that they've not had instruction by somebody else with any preconceived notions. They have to learn how to analyze for themselves a body of material and to master that body within a short period of time. And that, of course, is something that lawyers constantly have to do in practice. The first problem I had out of law school was an antitrust problem. I'd never taken antitrust in law school, and I had to first work a very long time trying to figure out what the problems were before I could begin to solve them. Our students are experienced in doing that throughout law school because of these courses. The other course is a legal drafting course. It too is, the students are given a choice as to the kind of drafting. They may choose a section on real estate or commercial or general office practice. These are again taught in very short, small sections, 15 students maximum. And they do four or five typical lawyer instruments, contracts, leases, whatever the instructors come up with, ranging from short assignments of having to draft a complicated clause that would take into consideration a rent escalation in case the highway that the restaurant is located on is moved within the next 3 years, to a major condominium agreement that would include lots of different provisions. Both advanced research and drafting are taught largely by adjuncts. We have some of our full-time faculty involved as anchors in those courses, but they are largely taught by lawyers from Chicago. We have, of course, a great resource here, who are actively engaged in those areas and are expert in them. In the senior year, the students have a choice, again, of doing either independent study under the supervision of one of the full-time members of the faculty. For that, they have to write a major law review type paper, 25 to 50 pages, and go through at least two drafts before it is approved. Or they may do it by taking one of the 30 or so seminars that the school offers in many different areas, anything from jurisprudence through civil rights through estate planning. Once again, they would do a 25 to 50 page paper, usually of a law review nature. And again, we have to do a rewrite plus lead a class discussion. By the time they have graduated, therefore, in the required curriculum alone, they would have gone through 18 required assignments of every style and type of legal writing. In drafting, and certainly I failed to mention that at least one of the assignments there is a plain English requirement assignment, so we don't neglect that. And at least one is a drafting from scratch, we call it, where there are no forms in existence, where they have to come up with things on their own. Once again, in the drafting course, incidentally, they may not have had very much in the way of real estate law or commercial law as a background. And so they are again doing research as a preliminary to writing in an area that they have already not received instructions. Let me quickly go through the benefits and the cost of this program. Obviously, it's an expensive program. With 10 full-time instructors in the first year, you can guess how much that part alone costs. The computers are also, of course, an aspect of this, and some of you last night at least heard a description of how we've in the past integrated the computers in the program and how we plan to do some more of that in the future. The benefits, however, have been very, very great. Just as an example, last year alone, 9 of our graduates were teaching legal writing at other schools, including 2 who are sitting here today. There was something like 18 judicial law clerks in the Seventh Circuit, in the Federal District Court, and the Illinois Supreme Court. In a short period since 78, in placement, the number of firms recruiting on campus has gone from about 25 to 125. And just about every major firm in the city has hired a graduate. Now, we don't attribute that only to the writing program. The school has obviously grown a great deal in other respects as well. But many of the firms do claim that they are very, very impressed with the program and the quality of the writing skills that our students possess and that they are sought after. I think that Laurel is correct, however, in one respect, and just I will finish on this note, that you don't get instant glory or instant feedback or instant welcome. Our students come in knowing about the program and how difficult it will be. And, of course, they still gripe while going through it. But what you do and what you do get is a lot of, later on, after they've graduated, feedback of how glad they were to have gone through it that way and how better off they are for it. We have lots of anecdotes of students who have told us that they didn't have any fears of doing anything because they already gone through everything they possibly could while they were in school. Almost instantaneously they were made the appellate department of their firm and have argued cases before the Illinois Supreme Court, for example, within a short time. And that they can still hear us preaching in their ears about writing for the audience and making it simple and clear and concise. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Shirley Bisewitz, and she's going to talk about the role of the librarian.
I'm very happy to be here as a former law librarian to discuss the role of the law librarian and the library staff in teaching legal research.
And I am especially happy to circle that problem,
research, because I haven't heard it until today, and I'm so glad that Professor Brill stole my entire thunder. I am so happy, because then you're not going to say, well, she's prejudiced because she was a former law librarian and is now a law professor. It seems to me I had to remind this group that the section of the American Association of Law Schools is called Legal Research and Legal Writing, because there are only about four of us here today, law librarians. And someone said, they haven't been coming. Maybe they haven't been coming because they haven't been asked to stress the research aspects. But now, this morning, we have the model of my talk here at Chicago Kent in the form of Brill's best model, because that is my model. Well, now it's not going to sound as if I'm preaching. And I'm just so happy because I come to recommend that we go back to legal research classes, that they be segregated and yet integrated. Now, historically, in the 1920s, about half of the law schools were teaching legal bibliography separately. I wasn't born at that time, you might think I was, but I'm recommending we go back to segregating the course. And yet, I'm going to recommend integration. In the 1940s, legal method was the popular course, and that's probably true today. And these courses emerged with legal research, I thought, as an important component. Now, since the emergence of this ALL section in the 1970s, we were a little late in forming it, but better late than never, on legal research and writing, the literature of the programs proliferates. The discussions proliferate, and we know all the variations. We know that we expect wonders. We have high expectations and impossible dreams and themes that come out with overworked staff, large turnover of personnel. And there is a lot of discussion of this in the literature. I found no article recently, since the formation of this section, discussing the segregation of legal research or bibliography. And that's why I was glad to have the opportunity to underline the importance of it. We all know what the literature says about the use of full-time faculty in the programs, part-time faculty, teaching associates, teaching assistants, the use of Oxford people we used in our program one year. And I've lived through the whole gamut of this. Basically, the courses are the same. We have variations in the details. And I think, that if your faculty is like mine, the legal research and writing courses or legal method courses have been under constant review. I was going to say triennially we evaluated the course, and then it was biennially. Well, the last 3 years, it's annually. We re-evaluate it. We don't even stop to think of what has happened to give the program a try. We're ready to change it. I wonder why faculty spend all their time evaluating legal method courses, and a lot of times they don't even teach it because we've delegated the responsibility to other people who turn over 1 or 2 years. And is this because maybe they don't want to evaluate their own substantive courses? I don't know. I just offer that question as an interesting sideline. So my first conclusion then is to delegate the primary responsibility of teaching legal research to librarians. Why? Why delegate? Why segregate? I have lived through the segregation in the early part of my tenure. Now I think it's the time for us to look again at our objectives and wonder if we can fill these impossible dreams and goals and objectives of our courses better by going back to segregating it to the research specialists and then integrating it after the first semester. Let's look at the AALS standard, since we are guided by this, number 10. It states, the law librarian shall be a full participating member of the faculty. Let's look at the ABA standard, number 18. It states, the law librarian shall be administered by a full-time librarian whose principal activities are the development of the collection, maintenance of the library, and may include teaching courses in the law school. So, we find that the librarian wears two hats. If you notice throughout the meeting here, I only wear one hat now. But at one time I wore two hats, one as administrator of the library and the other as a law professor of the faculty. I'm just here to remind you that let's delegate that second hat to the librarian again and make her or him earn that status. According to a survey done by two law librarians, Brock and Edelman, they learned recently that 70% of the responding law librarians, and they got a good sample, I think they got 135 returns out of 179 questionnaires that were sent out. 75% of those responding teach legal research in a structured setting. So, again, I think that we should delegate this responsibility to them. And why? Because the law librarian has the expertise. They have the BA degree, maybe it's BS, or whether the BS is formal or informal, and they have the JD degree. They have a third degree in this specialty. And this is reminiscent of the article that was written by me in the newspaper when I got my library science degree. There was a big headline, Lawyer Gets Third Degree. So it was funny, but I thought that is an added specialty now, which research is indigenous to the lawyer. It's inherent in the profession. And then secondly, the librarian is the research generalist, whereas the law professor is the legal specialist in a particular subject. Now, the law professor may very well know more about the law librarian, more than the law librarian knows in his particular or her particular specialty. But it is the law librarian that sees the broader spectrum. And that's why the law librarian should have an effective part in the research teaching of the legal research and writing programs. For example, I remember, and this is just as an example, it's not making a judgment, I just tell you the story. A colleague of mine taught legal research and writing because we thought one person should get the full responsibility of teaching it all, and I went with it. I had my own section, so I didn't care. I thought maybe the comparison and challenge would be great. So the students in this professor's class learned all about Rawls' theory of justice. Better than I know it, I'm sure. But I've been filling in the gaps about how to use the Federal Register system, how to use ALR, how to use American Digest system, how to cite weekly, and I'm not exaggerating, weekly, and that's W-E-E-K-L-Y, I hope. I get calls on how do I cite thus and so. they don't even know about Harvard's Blue and White Book, or whichever, I guess we're calling it the Blue Book now. Because this professor is the type that likes to sit in the ivory tower and think great thoughts and produce great works, and thinks that legal research is unimportant or something that you can, you know, that this is self-service. You know, like a self-service supermarket, you're supposed to go into the library and know how to do it all by yourself and pick out all the best indices, bibliographies, etc. But you can't do any effective legal writing unless you find the sources of the law. They don't care about, you know, bisuits on commercial law. Nothing. They want to know what the uniform commissioners on the commercial code think. They want to know what McCormick says about evidence. And you have to find the sources before you can expound on them and analyze them. So let's remember what the first basic step is. Before you write, you have to do your research. It's amazing, oversimplified. But I think we must remind ourselves of that. Now, librarians get very excited when, you know, West comes out with the bankruptcy reports. They get very excited when Little Brown's going to have a new treatise in antitrust, or when Foundation Press brings out a new casebook. And if we get that excited about it, we like to talk about it to the students, and maybe the contagion of excitement will take place. The law library staff always has taught on a one-to-one basis. So whether they took education courses or not, they have to do it. They would welcome teaching in groups because it would save them time. And logically, they could leave the sophisticated questions for the one-to-one basis or the one-to-one contact. It would certainly centralize their basic material in groups and leave the other questions for the individual attention. Why, again, should the law librarians do the research? Because they are the only continuing force and continuing component of this legal research and writing program, and they have illustrated a commitment to keep things up to date, to learn about the proliferation of all the publication printed materials that come out, the different formats, the microforms, the microfiche. They have been committed to going to all these workshops on automation and all the new databases. They have been the ones to start with personal computers and to get excited about Lexis, Westlaw, Nexus, Dialog, BRS, or what have you. And they would make up for the turnover that exists in the legal writing component. Most law professors have happily relinquished the teaching of automation to the library staff. We're not all, you know, like Chicago Kent or McGeorge, but that those institutions should be our role models, and maybe we'll have automation specialists and law library specialists separate at some point, which I endorse. I think they would be very happy for us to remind them to relinquish and delegate the teaching of legal research back to the law librarians, because they keep up with all the new publications and new databases. Time. I just want to say that because of automation, some commentators like Lancaster think that automation of library materials will eliminate the need for a law librarian. And they will eliminate the need for library staffs. I do not feel that way. Richard Danner of Duke Law School states, "With fewer subject indexes and bibliographies to assist the researcher, you need librarians for effective and efficient searches. Despite the ease of convenience of search, many scholars prefer to have their searches done for them, either by their legal research assistants or by the librarians.
Ebersol of Legal Research Corporation thinks that despite the friendliness and accessibility of current legal research systems, systems have been used more effectively cost-wise and subject-wise when a designated CALR specialist is available to assist a person in doing in conducting the research. Many scholars do so few researchers to gain the expertise of the law librarian or the automation specialist. Now, I've spoken about segregation of the legal research component. I forgot to mention, though, in the segregation prior to the... I think that we should consider programs like Chicago Kent and Southern Cal, which start the program before the first day of law school, because you have eager, rabid law students ready to learn. That's when you get them. Moving along to the integration then, some law schools have the courses as Chicago Kent in advanced legal research. I will refer you to integrating it in second and third years to an article by Robin Mills of Emory, who has a blueprint in her recent Law Library Journal article entitled Legal Research and Instruction After the First Year of Law School. And you have Brill's programs, but something no one has ever mentioned, and I wish to mention, is the continuing legal education program should include research. I've spoken to probate judges on how to do legal research. Every week, some lawyer says, let's have a brush-up course on how to do legal research. Now, if I forgot some important material, Michelle, I hope I've strengthened the icebergs. And if I started with my conclusions, I followed Marjorie's pattern. And I don't know if I'll pass the writer's workbench, but I think you get the general idea.
Thank you, Shirley. We're now going to have a short panel discussion, and Helene Chappell and Marjorie Rumbar are going to participate, as well as the speakers. And I'm going to call on Helene first.
I'm going to try not to be too disorganized, since I am these are not prepared remarks. I think we have a hit on this morning what may be one of the areas in real dispute and areas of controversy in the subject matter. I think most of us agree a lot that we have to teach our students legal thinking, legal reasoning techniques. Certainly that we have to teach them writing, whether it's legal writing or just writing as normal people and not just law students. But the last couple of years I have become very aware, and this is not a sensitivity on my part, I usually get hit over the head with it, that there is a dispute about how we can either integrate or segregate effective research, teaching research to the first-year students. I'm going to bring this down into the first-year course, because I think most of us teach a first-year course in legal writing, and that in most schools, as at my school, this is the only required course. We have at Northwestern also an upper-class writing requirement that can be satisfied in several different ways. But I'm going to drop that part of it off and just concentrate on the first-year course. The real difficulty that a lot of us face is in planning our curriculum. And most of us do try to incorporate reasoning, writing, and research. And I think that most of us, I think we disagree with you. And we've done this before, actually, at a small meeting as part of an ALS January meeting, that I think it does a disservice to the teaching of research to separate it out. I think that, not because of the librarians teaching it, who are obviously the most trained and the most knowledgeable about that area, but because I don't think the students learn it as well when research is divorced from other things that they're doing. I'm not really very good on learning theory in terms of being able to cite to you where I can back this up. But I think people learn better when the new activity is attached to something that is meaningful to them and something that they know already. We try to bring the research activity onto something that they are doing already, onto a memo assignment, when it is meaningful to the student to learn how to do the research in the library and to be able to focus on the strategies that the person needs, what information they need, where they're going to find that information, the best ways of finding that information, and the strategies that are going to help them in doing this project that is a meaningful project to them, maybe only because it's an assignment and they have to complete it, and perhaps they're going to get graded on it, or at least they're going to have a pass-fail. And integrating it into that, I think, is a better way for the students to learn than having the research done as a separate course or a separate lectures weekly, the way a lot of us did do it, and separate sort of the treasure hunt type of assignments. I prefer to do it with assignments that are going to teach them research that they need for a memo that I have given them. And we do prepare if I were doing it on a computer, I would call it a programmed assignment, the manual version of a programmed assignment, to send them to the library to learn the material there in conjunction with lectures that we give, to find the research that they need for one of the memos. And we prepare a very long and very trying for the students assignment that does that. What we do not do is some of the more sophisticated research. And I think that is where the law librarians become unhappy with us. We do not do international law. We do not do the tax services. We do not do the security services. We don't do that kind of advanced research. I'm sure you can tell me millions of other things that we don't include, because I don't think that those are relevant to a first-year student. We have, in a first-year course, a very limited time. Our course is 2 hours a semester, which is probably more than some of yours and less than some of yours. It is fewer hours of credit than any other course that they take. And I am going to use those hours in the way I think are the most productive. I think that teaching first-year students international law or the securities reporters or the tax reporters is an unproductive use of their time and of my two credits, or their two credits, I suppose, because they're not going to remember it. It's going to take them a long time to understand it. For example, the tax services are done by the code sections and the reg sections, and they don't know the code, and they don't know the regs, and they don't know what they are. So I don't spend my 2 hours on those things. They learn the loose leaf services. They learn the concept of the loose leaf services. We use an example. We use Law Week, for example, to teach them to use a loose leaf service where it is a relevant tool, but we don't do the specialized ones. I think that the only way to accommodate our needs and our students' needs in the first year and our use of those two credits and their later needs and the law librarians' unhappiness with us is to do what is being done, what you heard it at this morning from Rathbell and about Puget Sound, is to have an advanced course. That it is only, I think, in the second and third years that the other materials, the more advanced materials, is going to be relevant, is going to make sense to the students. And that's when I think that it should be taught to them. So that would be my solution to the problem. You didn't do the... you did the segregation part. You didn't do the integration part too much, and I don't know if you
was running out of time.
Yeah. Maybe panel, you'd have
Chicago Kent certainly has done part. All the ideas that I have in integration.
Yeah.
We agree.
So I think we agree. Well, I think we agree on more, but I think
okay.
We certainly agree on the way on the solution to that problem. There are many other ways of integrating the research, which we can probably do a little bit in the panel or in the smaller sections. Ms. Marjorie.
I can only admire what Laurel has done at UPS in terms of developing a program with the training of the teachers as well as the training of the students. And I stand in awe of what has happened at Tri-Kent with their three-year program. But if there is one thing that I would want all of you to take back to your schools, it's this. We are not teaching legal research. We are not teaching legal writing. We are not teaching legal reasoning as separate skills. We are teaching a process. In an ideal world, that's what we should be teaching. I call it a legal problem-solving process. You call it what you wish. It's a thinking process that utilizes some of the skills that we talk about as discrete parts of the total process. We do not need further compartmentalization in the law school. Already, that's what's wrong with our legal education. We have students who learn to think in compartments about constitutional law, about civil procedure. What we need is an integration, and maybe you would have got to this point, too. In our actual world, most of us have a first-year course. And since we have only that one course, I think we should strive for the ideal of putting together and teaching our students the process and not individual skills.
One of the other solutions is also one on which we agree, that beyond having courses beyond the first year course, that one of the other solutions is to have somebody teaching that course who is a continuing person. Because that's the person who can work with a law librarian, who does keep up with the materials in the library and how they are changing. When you have a constant turnover of people coming in just before the semester starts, and then leaving at the end of the semester, the end of the year, then you do get the kind of problems I think that you're talking about.
I thank Shirley for her kind words. I don't mean to represent that we're a model of anything. But having the advanced courses does free you from a lot of things you cannot do in your first year. You can use the first year as a building block for other things. I think Laurel is absolutely right in what she's doing in her first, in what turns out to be an extension of her first year course in the second, by having it so structured. But I also think there's a word to be said for flexibility. Writers, legal writers at least, have to learn that they have to write for different audiences and that they have to be exposed to different philosophies of writing and not just to one method or one mold. Working as an associate in a law firm, you may have to write for four or five different partners, one of whom wants complex prose and one who wants short and simple, get to the point. The same is true for judges. The same is true for different kinds of documents. Consumer documents may have to be very simple so the client can understand it. Other documents may have to be more traditional and use legalese. I think you have to therefore expose people to different models of good writing in different contexts and different theories of it. By having upper level courses with different instructors, our students have to learn that what they learn in the first year may not be acceptable for that second year instructor. He or she may have different theories of what constitutes good writing. There are no standards of what is absolutely good writing, and that therefore they have to learn different things. I agree that basic first-year instructors should be given lots of training and instruction on how to teach. I at least would not want to make it quite as formalized as Laurel's program is in saying this is what you must do on this day in this method. My instructors are given a great deal more flexibility as to what they do at any one time. We stay together on deadlines, on assignment, on page limitations, on the books that we use. We do give some general lectures that are in common to all the sections. But within those, each of the instructors is allowed a great deal of freedom as to how he or she teaches that section. And I think that's, on the whole, I think that's advisable because it gets them started at an early time learning that different things may be done. As far as legal research, of course, I do agree that we don't emphasize that too much in our section. And in the past, we have held a couple of our annual meetings on legal research. I think the law librarians can be integrated into the programs. I don't think they should be shunned and avoided. They're doing a wonderful job. However, Shirley misstates too much what we do with ours. They don't teach the legal research component. In the first year, we do our research by teaching assistants primarily and the instructors. They do help out in the second advanced research course. They're offering instruction in legislative histories and in some other aspects. Thank you.
Well, let me just summarize. I believe in segregating the legal research component prior to entering the first semester, and then substantially most of the first semester. After that, I'm for all these programs that integrate, and we have spoken about the integration, except for one other way of doing it, which we have done at our school, and that is to have the law library staff or librarian go into a course, to all the writing courses later on, if there's a paper due in a course, and give that class a brush up on specialized research and bibliographies for that area, whether it be independent study or tax law or international law or environmental law. If it's not done as it is here at Chicago Kent, then the librarian could go and give at least a 1 hour shot to the whole group and then do the individual instruction later on. At any rate, we know what the goals are. To have legal research from the first day or from the summer of the law school right to the last day of law school.
Well, thank you. I think this is a good time for us to stop right now and go for a coffee break, because then we're going to have 1 hour of small discussion groups when we continue this discussion. Laurel, do you think?
No, I mean, I just want to say we do give our teachers a tremendous amount of flexibility. The methods are suggested only.
And we'll have a 15-minute break for coffee. Then we're going to go to our small groups. Thank you.
We're in small groups. Still down.
Laurel, I thought that's not a coffee break. That's a coffee.
You can work out.